Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, friends. This is Penelope Silvers coming to you from the rainy state of Florida. And my very special guest today is Brian Dickinson. He's a former Navy rescue swimmer and climber to the summit of the highest mountain in the world, Mount Everest. He's a true adventurer, and he's tough not only physically but mentally, with a strong faith that can move mountains. And his faith did just that for him at the summit. He made it to the top but wasn't sure if he'd be able to make it down. But make it down he did, and we're grateful that he's here with us today to share a bit of his story from his book called Blind Descent. Welcome to Penelope's Book Chat, Brian.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. I'm curious, and then a lot of people I'm sure are curious, why would people risk their lives to climb a mountain?
Well, I think people that don't climb, which is, you know, probably the mass majority of people, you know, we all have our thing, you know, the thing that we're wired to do. So I think a lot of times when it's not your thing, you know, it's considered risking your life or just crazy, or I've been called everything. But when you're when you're there, when it is how you're wired, it's who you are, you know, you don't consider it as risking your life. It's about being fit. It's about exploring the world. It's about, you know, trying to do things that are within your control, but, you know, planning for things that are outside of your control and, you know, responding if it really comes down to that.
Yeah, that's great. Why do you personally do it?
I think it's changed over time. You know, I was an air rescue swimmer. I was jumping out of helicopters for a living for a while there in the Navy. And, you know, just, I think, like I said a second ago, like I'm wired differently. You know, I live in the Pacific Northwest. I have lots of large mountains around my house, and, you know, it's a great way to stay in shape. It's beautiful. It gets me, you know, away from the craziness at sea level, you know, away from so many people and just the other things that could, you know, car crash or something that could take me out. So I think it's just changed over time. I think spiritually it's just a good place to go reset and just, you know, gain some clarity.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your air rescue. How do you think that training that you had in the air rescue prepared you differently to climb a mountain?
I think not so much. Well, I mean, it's physically demanding, so I guess you could say it prepared me from that perspective. But I think just mentally, as far as knowing my limitations and, you know, being able to push beyond them and to, you know, go through all the land and water survival training to truly know what those limitations are and, you know, kind of how to predict them. And then, you know, when things aren't going so well, like my situation on Everest, you know, how to actually survive without panicking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think that would be very important, especially what you went through. And what was your first successful mountain climb that got you started?
Any mountain that you come down from is a successful climb. So I've had plenty of those. Yes. I grew up in Southern Oregon and lived in the mountains. Okay. So, I mean, I could say I grew up climbing. As far as like my first major peak, like highly glaciated peak, you know, being here in the Seattle area, Mount Rainier is right in my backyard. So it's a 14,000 foot peak. So definitely had a successful climb there and kind of got the bug to do more. And that's when I started climbing around the world.
Uh-huh. And that mountain you can see out your window, huh? So it was just calling to you?
Sort of.
How many climbs did you actually have under your belt before Everest?
I've been climbing my whole life. So, you know, it'd be probably in the hundreds. As far as like really big mountains, you know, I was climbing the highest peaks of the seven continents. So I'd been to, you know, climbed in Alaska, climbed all over the Pacific Northwest, climbed in Russia and Africa. So I had plenty of climbs, but there's nothing quite like being in the Himalayas and seeing the highest peak in the world because it's really hard to train for that since it's as high as you can go.
That's right. And you did it. That's amazing. And you mentioned in your book, it's an excellent book, by the way, you mentioned how important focus and faith is to your mountain climbing. You mentioned this a lot throughout the book. How can this help the rest of us in getting through the tough stuff of life?
Yeah. So on Everest, I soloed the mountain, and then at the top went blind and, hand over hand made my way down. And, I could have panicked. I could have freaked out, and I could be a permanent fixture on the mountain. But really got me down was just focus and faith. I couldn't look. Well, I couldn't look at all because I was blind. But I couldn't logically look at the whole situation because it could cause panic. And I had to get down. I had to focus on one step in front of the other, hand over hand, and just never give up faith. I was not going to die on that mountain. And I just, gave it all to Christ and just had a miracle up there.
Yes.
And I think through life, everyone has things that they're going through, and they're huge, whether it's a disease, a loss of life in the family, bad news, losing a job, anything. And I think it comes down to survival tactics. I mean, just don't lose focus, don't lose faith, you can get through this. It just takes one step at a time.
Mm. That's great. I'm sure there's a lot of people that need to hear that today. And I could actually picture you up on that mountain when you were talking about your family, and you were saying their names, Emily, Jordan, Joanna, Step. Emily, Jordan, Joanna, Step. I could actually see you up there doing that. And your family is everything to you. And I was amazed that you could actually get an internet connection up on a mountain. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that you could do that. And you could talk with your family. And how do you think that affected your ability to survive and make it back to them?
Well, I mean, it was my focus was getting back to them. You have to figure out that reason to have that will to survive. This was the first year, this was back in 2011, that they had internet. So they had a 3G connection on a village, which had a 3G tower. So it was only certain areas that you could get a connection, and it was very spotty. But I did have that linkage and that connection to my family, and that was my motivation. It's tough to go climb a mountain for 2 months and to be away from, my wife and two small children.
Yes,
so it was really tough. I mean, that's mentally and emotionally, that was the hardest part for me. But it was also, I mean, they were my anchor. They were getting me back home. I was not going to die on that mountain.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's amazing. Now, do your own children want to mountain climb?
They do. So they've climbed the highest peak in Australia, like the whole family went over there a few years ago. And, my son and I, we just got back, climbed, one of the highest peaks, actually the highest peak in the county here, which is a mix of glacier and rock climb. And he turns 10 in 2 days. So they do enjoy it. But, they enjoy a lot of things, and I'm not the type of dad that pushes them. In fact, my wife, being a Christian counselor, we kind of balance each other well, and we provide opportunities for the family. But, it's kind of learned behavior. They see the adventure that we've done together, and, they want to do that. I don't know if they'll elevate it to heights of Everest, but, I think they will always be adventurous.
Yeah. Yes, yes. They probably will have inherited that adventurous spirit from you, I'm sure. And I thought it was funny that you said that your wife is afraid of heights, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're totally opposite.
She's afraid of heights. Yeah, I know it. I know. Well, what kind of food did you eat on the mountain? And then tell us a little bit about yak pizza.
Yak makes you want a yak. So the food isn't great, over in the Khumbu Valley, which is like the 38-mile trek into Everest Base Camp. And then, it just kind of gets worse as you go in. And I guess it's relative, right? Because I'm from the Seattle area and the States. We have, certain food that we enjoy, and, there are places
Lots
around
of
the
good
world.
food there.
Yeah, so we go there, and honestly, I was worried about food handling and getting sick during my expedition.
Right.
So I was really careful about that and just eating, mostly vegetables, like vegetarian type stuff,
right.
and rice and dalbat, that's what they call it, lentils and rice.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the places it was their take on pizza. And we just called it yak pizza because we thought it had yak cheese on it. But I guess yaks, you can't really make cheese from yaks. But it was just basically dough and, something on it. But it seemed safe. It seemed cooked
something
through.
On
and
it.
Yeah.
I can imagine. So how did that yak pizza taste? Was it, I guess it was passable.
It was, yeah, exactly. I survived
it
on
passable.
It.
You had to have some protein.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved how you went to orphanages before your climb. Tell us what you did when you went to these orphanages before you did your climb on Everest.
Yeah, so I've climbed all around the world, and I always use it as an opportunity to visit orphanages, and I'll do like a toy drive so I can deliver gifts to the underserved children, and it's so little, but it seems big to them at the moment, just that someone cares about them when the world is just kind of let them go. And I've had the opportunity to have my kids, when they're super young, go to Argentina and go to a children's hospital as well as an orphanage,
mm-hmm.
and hand out toys. And then my wife and daughter did a missions trip to Swaziland, Africa last year, where they were just immersed in a village. Yeah, they're there for a couple of weeks and just teaching life skills to these kids and families. But before Everest, I went to the Early Childhood Development Center, and the lady running it, Pushpa Basnet, was actually the CNN Hero of the Year later that year, which is awesome,
mm-hmm.
because in Nepal, when parents go to jail, for whatever reason, they bring their kids. So then kids grow up behind bars. It's just a really broken system. And what Pushpa has done is created this environment where the kids don't have to go to jail. They live in like an orphanage, and she teaches them life
mm-hmm.
skills, and then they can go visit their parents. So I was very fortunate to go there. And because I worked with Cisco, I worked with our philanthropic group to coordinate multiple orphanages around the world. And then we had a scientist
mm-hmm.
come in, and we had live video and audio, and they built like musical instruments out of popsicle sticks and rubber bands. So it was just really neat have that interaction of people around the world.
Yes.
And, most of these kids have no clue and that, that there's others out there like them. So it's a really just magical experience for them all.
Oh, that's neat. Now, what area on Everest were you most concerned about climbing?
So right out of base camp. So it takes a week and a half just to get to base camp. It's all on foot, 38 miles, and the altitude at base camp is 17,500 feet. And then you start actually climbing up the mountain. And right outside of base camp is the Khumbu Icefall, which is it's just a couple miles of basically rivers of falling ice and ice blocks called seracs, which are the size of buildings. So it's a really dangerous area, and I had to go up and down that 8 times as I was acclimating. And it's actually the same location that there's been a couple disasters in the last couple of years, where 16 Sherpa, which are the local people that live in Nepal, got crushed by a massive block of ice that fell. And then, of course, earthquakes that happened a couple of years ago that just killed, multiple people there in base camp. So, yeah,
mm-hmm.
just right out of the gates, right out of base camp, is actually the most dangerous area, which you have to traverse often.
Okay, that's kind of surprising. You would think it would be someplace a lot higher than that, but right there at the beginning.
Yeah, it's dangerous up there, too.
Yeah, sure. The whole thing.
Different levels of danger, I guess.
Yes, lots of danger. And I was amazed to learn how you get over the crevasses. Did I say that right? Crevasses.
Crevasses. Mm-hmm.
Did I say okay? How do you get over those crevasses? I mean, these big, wide, open spaces that you can just fall right into.
Yeah, you don't want to fall in because you may not come out, because they're deep. I mean, they can be hundreds of feet deep and, you know, quite a ways apart, you know, 10, 20, 30 plus yards. So there's the Nepalese actually hire icefall doctors is what they call them, which are Sherpa, that there's like five of them that every day they kind of go through and change the route, and they'll bring in ladders, these really cheap aluminum ladders, and tie them together. So I would cross all that. You know, I'd have all my gear, the spikes on my boots, and attached to a rope, but crossing these ladders. Some places where five ladders were tied together, and just kind of cruising across, and that thing swinging back and forth. And it's a balancing act for sure. And every time I did go through, it was changed because it's a river of flowing ice. Like, it just keeps changing, or avalanches kick off and wipe out the route. And sometimes we'd have to rappel down into the crevasse and cut across and climb back out. So it was always a new adventure going up and down.
So you were like a tightrope walker, almost walking across these big, wide open spaces on aluminum
ladders.
Yeah,
you get good at it though.
Oh. I guess so.
You get better balance as you go.
I guess you do. Now, the higher that you go, there are some issues that can arise as well from less oxygen. So what kind of things can come up the higher you climb?
Yeah, so Everest is the summit's at 29,035 feet. So up there above 26,000 feet, they call it the death zone. And it's there's a third of the air up there. So you just can't survive. If you were to pluck your body from sea level and put yourself up there, you'd pass out and die. So your body has to acclimate to survive without that much air. And that's why you actually acclimate. That's why I would climb up and down the mountains. I'd go up, you know, a couple thousand feet of vertical, come all the way back down to base camp, and down there my body will produce red blood cells, which carry oxygen. So then I'd go up a little higher and then come back down. So it takes about a month to fully acclimate so that you can attempt the summit. But yeah, if you go up too fast, you'll get different types of edema, which will affect the brain or the heart or the lungs, to where it can be fatal.
So you truly have to be an adventurer to do this, because there's all kinds of things that can happen. Now, what?
Yeah, you had to summit.
Yes, you had to summit Everest completely alone. What happened?
So it was just myself and Pasong, climbing Sherpa, and we'd been climbing for the month prior leading up to it, and he'd had three other summits prior, and this was my first attempt. And as we were heading up, it was just the two of us, which is very unusual, because on Everest, there's only a couple days out of the year that you can actually summit. But we just happened to be in a position where we were going for the summit wedged between two other days that people had attempted. So very rare. And as we're heading up at about 28,000 feet, he wasn't feeling well. So we had a conversation, and, you know, he said he was just going to wait there while I continued up. And he ended up going down to the high camp, but I continued up. You know, you only have the information you have in front of you at the time. So made that decision, and you live and die by decisions in the death zone, and continued up. And I soloed the top. And according to the Himalayan database, I'm one of two people to ever truly be up there alone.
Which, oh, wow.
You know, definitely wasn't something, not something I planned, but it, you know, just kind of worked out that way. And it was, it's surreal. I mean,
that's amazing.
In the moment, though, it's one of those odd things, because everything's going in slow motion because there's such a lack of air up there, and it's really hard to process it all. It's almost like you're aware that you are trying to process it. Like, I am here. Mm-hmm. I've made it. You know, you're exhausted, emotional, and just proud, everything that goes along with it. It's just a really cool moment.
That is neat. Well, congratulations on that. That's That is awesome. Now, once you reach the summit, that's amazing in itself. But what happened to you once you reached the summit?
Yep. So I got up there and I took some pictures and made a radio call down and then start heading down. And, you know, within a few feet, I went completely snowblind. And what snowblindness is, it's sunburning of the cornea. So I have blue eyes. So I'm more susceptible. But I had damaged my goggles the day prior and, you know, ripped an internal lens out. Goggles have two lenses, and not realizing that that cut their effectiveness in half. And as soon as the sun came up, banked off the ice with, you know, being so high up there with so little protection from the ozone, it fried my eyes. And with snow blindness, it's not like where you're blind, where everything's black. It's where everything is bright white. If you put a light bulb like an inch in front of your eyes, you cannot see anything. And it's very, very painful.
Oh, that would, yes. That would be so strange. And once you contracted that snow blindness, then you had to get down. And then you said, you said in your book, you said that you did not feel alone, even though you were alone, as you were coming down. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, the whole time I just, you know, right when I knew I was snowblind, you know, I dropped down and grabbed a rope that I was attached to and just kind of assessed the situation and knew I had been blind and I was alone. And, you know, without overthinking it or panicking, I just got up and started moving. I knew I had to start moving back to focus and faith. And this whole time, you know, just one step in front of the other, knowing that there's a 2-mile drop, you know, to sure death from the top there. I felt this presence around me. I just never felt alone. It's like if you're in the room with someone, you close your eyes, you know they're there, but you can't see them. It was just that same calming, just peaceful, calming presence. And I didn't think too much about it, but it was just, it was always there.
And you attribute that to the Holy Spirit being with you.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And then you also said in the book that at the same time, you found this out later, but at the same time you were trying to descend, there was a major cry out to God all at the same time from you and also in some other places. What happened there?
So I was coming down and I'd made it to about the halfway point. I'd already taken a major fall, rode out a slab avalanche, and reached the point where Pasong was supposed to be. And, you know, called out to him, but he wasn't there. So I figured he went down to high camp. And I continued. And at that point, you know, this would have been after over 33 hours of continuous climbing from the day prior to this point. I ran out of oxygen. My mask started sucking in around my face. And I remember ripping it off and just dropping to my knees and praying. At that moment, I mean, it's very simple. I'd been trying to do it on my own. And at this moment, I just, I knew I could not. And I just asked God, I said, I can't do this alone. Please help me. And like you'd mentioned, I found out later at that very moment, I had Joanna, my wife, people, her friends, people I didn't even know who reached out to me, you know, weeks and months later telling me that they just felt the need to pray for me in that moment and just to lift me up. And back on the mountain, when I said that simple prayer with, you know, immediately I just felt this energy come over me and just lift me to my feet. And I scrambled around for an oxygen bottle that had previously failed and got the regulator on. And then I got a positive flow. Air started coming out. And I just taking those deep breaths, like 5 deep breaths, and just the pain of air reentering my body. But, you know, I was alive. And again, without overthinking it, I put all my gear back on and just started getting down as fast as I could, rappelling down like 20 pitches until I eventually made it into high camp.
Oh, that's wonderful. What a story, I'll tell you. And what a miracle you are. What a miracle that God has performed, bringing you back home.
Yeah.
That was my feeling when I read it, you know, complete miracle.
Yeah, that's my feeling being there, for sure. It's,
yes,
there's 200 plus bodies still on the mountain, and, you know,
I know.
You know, why am I here? And
right,
I don't know. But
right.
I know I've been able to talk to a lot of people and to change a lot of lives. So I think there's a greater purpose that I was unaware
yes.
of at the time.
Yes, I think so. I do believe that. Do you still have problems with your vision?
I do. I have astigmatism, so I mean, I'm getting okay. older, so you can attribute it to that. But
aren't we all?
My left eye is definitely worse than my right, and even after Everest, it took about a month and a half for me to fully regain my vision.
Mm. Okay, Art, and how has this experience changed you?
It's definitely given me a different perspective, you know, in life, and it's put me in a spotlight that I never asked for, you know, never considered.
Right.
But it's been such a blessing just to see the impact that something like this can have on others, and just how many people reach out who are struggling, and just, you know, I just got emails today about people that were, you know, listening to the audio version of my book, and a girl mm-hmm. in Colorado, a seventh grader, who's doing her school paper on me, and, you know, it's crazy.
Neat.
Just how, yeah,
yeah,
it's really neat. It's very, very humbling for sure, because I'm just
yeah.
me, I'm
yeah.
normal Brian, but, you know, I've just had this miracle, and it's definitely a blessing. And like I said earlier, it's just when you realize that there is a greater purpose, and I think we all have that greater purpose, and at some point we just get it and we realize, wow, this is why.
This is it. Are you still climbing today?
Yes. Yeah. So the whole Everest thing is, you know, it's I don't want to call it a fluke.
Uh-huh.
Definitely preventable. It never happened before. Yep. It's just one of those things. But yeah, I've been to Antarctica and, you know, different places around the world, and
wow,
still getting out. I mean, that's who I am. I'm, you know, I'm not trying
right.
to go higher than Everest, because it's not possible, but I'm not
right.
you know, doing
no
a ton of stuff
here.
And no, just definitely doing, I mean, this earther is definitely no shortage of adventures, and just an exciting place to live if we actually get out and live it.
That's great. I love that. The other day I heard a song. I don't know if you know this song by Johnny Diaz. It's called Breathe, Just Be. I thought about you when I heard that song, because, you know, when you're up there on the mountain all by yourself, that's really
mm-hmm.
all you're doing. It's just focusing on that one breath. You know, one breath after another, and it's just you and God on that mountain.
Yep, definitely.
I just want to thank you for being my guest today, Brian. I pray that your story has blessed our listeners as much as it has blessed me.
Oh, thank you.
And you can find more about Brian at his website listed below the show page. And I also encourage each of you to purchase Brian's book. It is riveting, encouraging, and will inspire each of you in moving your own personal mountains. Have a good night, everyone.